From the burning deserts of the Middle East to the frozen frontiers of Antarctica, retired Navy Captain Kevin Ball served with the legendary Seabees, building what others said couldn't be done. In this episode, he shares stories of battling the enemy and the elements, leading under pressure, and proving that construction can be as daring as combat. This is a glimpse into the life of a man who helped build the Navy's backbone in some of the toughest places on Earth. These experiences have given him a unique perspective on life and offers advice on how not to just survive, but succeed in life. And in the end, he shares his proudest accomplishments as a naval officer. We will join Captain Ball right after this word from our sponsor. You know, some of my favorite TV shows and movies are from the Star Trek franchise. And you always knew the excitement was about to begin when the USS Enterprise went from impulse power to warp drive. For you non-Trekkers out there, that meant they were going to go really fast as they rushed to their next big adventure. That, my friends, is what it is like when you use EL Internet Northwest for your internet service. Why travel at impulse speed when you can go into warp drive? And your connection will be secure and stable. No more worrying about your favorite show or ball game freezing up at critical moments. With signal towers covering almost all of Boundary County and parts of Northern and Bonner County, it is very likely that you can be up and running in no time. The local technicians of EL Internet stand by ready to hook you up. To get more information, call 208-946-4147 or go to their website at elinternetnw.com. Again, that phone number is 208-946-4147. It might even be your neighbor who answers the phone, and tell them Ted sent you. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another podcast of Almost Paradise in North Idaho. And I am your host, Ted Ludlum. And if you have been listening faithfully for the past year, thank you very much. And if you're new and you just found us by accident, welcome to my humble experiment of doing a podcast. Okay. And we are located up in North Idaho, about 30 miles from the Canadian border. And the weather has been very nice lately, not bad at all. And today, I have a guest on that I think you might find very interesting. And his name is Captain Kevin Ball of the Civil Engineering Corps, retired from the United States Navy Reserve. Kevin, how you doing?
Fine, sir.
And you might find it interesting, as an audience, I met Kevin at our local county fair just a week or two ago. And he was standing outside one of our booths, and I was helping out with a booth, and we just started talking. I go, hey, you got to be on my podcast. And Kevin said,
sure, why not?
And there you go. So Kevin is retired, and I'm going to give you just a quick little rendition of his resume, because he's got a lot of stuff going on for him. And originally was from Painted Post, New York. Captain Ball grew up in Southern California, and he obtained a bachelor's in engineering from UCLA and a master of science in systems management from the University of Southern California. And after a five-year active and reserve enlistment in the Navy, Captain Ball was commissioned in the Naval Civil Engineering Corps. And Captain Ball held active duty positions as engineering officer, naval support force in Antarctica?
That's the fun part.
That's the fun part. Now, I will say this. I'm a big Star Trek guy. And if you're familiar with the original Star Trek, and Scotty, the engineer for the USS Enterprise, he often told Captain Kirk, I just fix things and make things work. And that's what you did and do.
That's what I enjoyed.
That's what you enjoyed. And interestingly enough, he also was a soccer referee for the Special Olympics, United States Games, just a variety of different things. And so we're going to touch on some things. He is married to the former Cheryl Lynn Warner from California, who was a respiratory therapist for 42 years before her retirement. And they both now live in Bonner Ferry.
Correct.
Now, I always ask my question, my guests this, okay? How did you find Varner's Ferry?
We adopted two boys when I was around 40, and over time, wound up one needed to go to Boulder Creek Academy that used to be up here.
I was a driver for Boulder Creek Academy for a few years, for a while, yes.
Yeah, well, visiting up here, so we became acquainted with some people whose parents had either passed on or they're estranged or whatever, and became a maternal, paternal figures to them that asked advice of. But we were looking up here, and we were living west of Seattle on the Kitsap Peninsula for prior 28
years. Beautiful area there.
It used to be beautiful.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Yeah, and I know what you mean, yes.
He said, I do not want to retire in Washington State. How about Varner's Ferry? And so that's what basically got our interest here.
And your wife was totally, totally supportive of that?
Yes, she was fine. She was fine with coming out here. She liked the area, so.
It worked out. It worked out well. And you said you've actually lived in Varner's Ferry for what? 5 years, 10 years?
I moved in January of 15, and my wife followed the following September when she retired.
Okay.
Out west.
And I also like to ask this now, just for more information, background information. Kevin is 72 years old.
Correct.
And as I said, he is retired. And how would you describe, why is this area almost paradise?
It's the reason we chose to live up here. We have some open space. The vast majority of people are wonderful up here. Neighbors help neighbors, doors, the open doors, elderly people. So it's...
People wave at each other.
Yeah. My wife says I don't wave back, but in my Gator, I'm paying attention to driving. So now I just reflex and just wait more now.
Now, you are classic North Idaho in that you drove up to the house here in your... it's like an ATV, the Gator.
Yeah.
Side by side or...
It's seats three. He's got a cab and a massive 23 horsepower diesel.
It's not a car.
No, it's called a UTV.
Okay.
And yeah, a registered license.
And that's your popular vehicle of choice.
That's about all I drive here. In fact, a lot of people know the Gator, but they don't know me. So
okay. There he is.
Yeah. There's the Gator.
And so you just kind of like the lifestyle in general?
The lifestyle, yeah, the lifestyle in general. I have a tractor with a Raider scraper, and I also, in the winter, have a snowblower on it. I take care of our drive, the neighbor next door. There's a street down the side where they can't do it. And so you just help neighbors out.
And you live in an area called?
It's called Paradise Valley.
There you go.
For actually a bench, but they call it Valley.
Yeah. Yeah. How is this area? And I always ask this, and some people go, oh, this doesn't apply to me because I think it's wonderful. But for some people, how is this area not almost paradise?
Boy, that would probably get down to the level of just little
minor things. Here, okay.
Which would be okay. The biggest, most glaring one in my mind is they removed the stoplight from Alderson by Dick's.
And that's, yes, okay, that's,
okay.
Yes, that was controversial at the time.
Yeah.
We currently have two traffic lights in the entire county of Boundary County, and we only had one until just about a year ago. We added a second one, but to replace the one down there that you're talking about, when they decided to remove, that was a bit of controversy.
Yeah, and it's neighbors.
Yeah.
Especially during the high traffic that when school lets out.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's a problem.
I think traffic can be really busy on Highway 95 as it goes through town. And they did just recently, a few years ago, expand the road, the highway, to three lanes. Basically, they broadened the shoulders a little and they put in new lights. And it was quite the construction project. And there's still some locals or whoever, or maybe people from out of the area who... they're not quite sure how to navigate that middle lane. As they merge in from side stores or businesses or gas stations and so on. But yeah, I know exactly that intersection you're talking about. It's a little tricky. You just got to watch it. And you can get stuck there for a while.
Correct. My record for being stuck there was 8.5 minutes.
Wow. There you go. Yeah, it's almost, don't even try to go cross traffic.
For going south, we go down Kootenai Trail Road.
You make arrangements. You change your direction and your course and so on to accommodate or work with instead of working against the traffic. So that is a significant thing that it's not almost paradise. The traffic can be really annoying at times and sometimes dangerous. On Highway 95 south from Bonners Ferry down to Sandpoint and so on, it's a two-lane road. The road to the woods are close, and there's been a number of accidents there the last few years.
And they also had an accident. Remember when they widened the road and they put the black fencing down off the side of the road, the steel fencing?
Yes, yes.
The boundary tractor, they took it down so close to the driveway, you can't see around it.
No.
And so
it's a blind spot.
Eventually pulled it back, but it's still a blind spot. And that's where we had an incident where the front end of my wife's car got clipped because there is no visibility.
So
there's that.
So now that we've covered that, you've got such a interesting career with that kind of goes off to the right and it goes off to the left and goes up and down and this and that. What's the word? Eclectic career. Let's do this first. Tell me a brief history. What is or what are the CBs?
The CBs originally started out as a few words written on War Plan Orange, which was the Pacific War Plan that was done up in the late 30s. And then when World War II happened, CBs stand for construction battalions. We're going to have these Navy construction battalions that will go build things in advanced bases and airfields and that. And that's where it started.
And going back to that late 30s, as you mentioned before we turned the microphones on, there was a rising possibility of a war with Japan.
Correct.
And the Pacific Ocean and islands involved.
Correct.
And so they were doing some pre-planning, basically. Yeah. And so specifically, I interrupted you. You go ahead and tell me more about the CBs and what they were doing and stuff. Going into war.
Throughout the war, they were involved with building bases for the Marines, which was also utilized by Army Air Force, airfields, fueling facilities, piers, docks.
Yeah. Island by island.
Primarily in the Pacific. Following the war, there's a great drawdown of military.
And this is before your day.
Or before my. And then some build up back for the Korean conflict and then drawdown again and then build up again for the Vietnam era stuff, and post-Vietnam, there is a drawdown of that. So the size of the CBs goes up and down on need.
Now, some little trivia. I first learned of the CBs when I was like 10 years old, and the only reason was I watched this TV show called Leave It to Beaver. And Beaver's dad was Ward Cleaver, and he sometimes mentioned his time with the CBs in World War II. And so I go, oh, what's the CBs? And so I knew just enough to be dangerous, which is common for me to know just enough to be dangerous. And I knew it had something to do with construction and so on. But the emblem today for the CBs is what?
It is basically a bee with a stinger, and off each articulated arm is either a wrench or machine guns or whatever, and with a sailor hat on the head. And
yeah,
and that was from the early days, and that's still with us.
And because you have to build and at the same time be ready to fight.
Correct.
At any moment's notice, depending on what's going on.
Correct.
Yeah. So that's a multi-endeavor and challenge for sure.
Yeah. You have to balance it right.
Now, what motivated you or what got you involved in the military in general and the CB specifically?
Real quick, I originally started out of high school with an appointment to West Point. And so I'm back there for these barracks and that, but they didn't eventually like my eyes, so they gave me a choice. Do you want to be an E4 and go to Vietnam, or do you want to go out, let you go, and we'll get you honorable discharge? Let me see, I want to go to college. And took the honorable discharge, got back home, started school, pulled a draft number of 2.
Okay.
See, and then, there you go. I relate to this. I understand that. Yeah.
I said, I'm not going to go be a ground pounder in that. And I went down to the Naval Reserve Station and then Signal, California, and enlisted. Went to boot camp in A school. Graduated the first in the class out of A school. They asked me to take some training in electronic warfare. And that was pretty new. And then they basically went overseas on frequently extended assignments because there was a shortage of both operations specialists and electronic warfare.
So you're 72 and I'm 71. So I totally relate to that. And my draft number was 99. And at that time, that was I was told by people who knew, you're okay, you're fine. But I did do a semester of ROTC just in case.
Interesting time. As I was doing reserve stuff and some extended active duty to be on a 10 can off and on, and we were trying to wind it down.
When I was, and what's it?
10 cannons that destroyed.
Yes, I knew that. You knew everybody else.
Yeah, being on a destroyer is definitely not like being on a carrier.
It's not a kayak, no, but it's not an aircraft carrier either.
And when I graduated, I took a direct appointment and a commission into the Civil Engineer Corps and went back to Newport, Rhode Island in 76. Bicentennial tall ships.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I got to see that.
Did you see the USS Constitution? It's docked in Boston. I've always wanted to do that.
No, I had not personally walked up to and seen the Constitution.
Okay. This is an old warship from back in War of 1812 and stuff. And it's still a commissioned ship in the Navy, believe it or not. But it's for training and touristy public relations and so on. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it still has a commission, but it...
I don't think it's ready to fight anything. Yeah. But it was quite the ship in 1812. Yes, yes.
Yes, it was quite the ship in 1812.
Okay. So not to get too into the weeds. Now, I'm not saying your career is weeds. No, I don't mean that. But there, you just said so many things, and so we're just going to hit some highlights.
Okay.
And one of the highlights is, or to me it would be a low light, is being stationed in Antarctica. Okay. So tell me a little bit about Antarctica as an environment and the temperatures, and then what you did and when.
Okay. So my first mission job in 76 was engineering officer for Operation Deep Freeze. And
so this was only before global warming, and so it was really cold there.
It's still cold there.
It's still cold there, okay.
So, no, but my job was I'd fly in late winter before everybody else came down, and the first task was to lay out and build a 10,000-foot runway on the sea ice, along with the parking areas that they had all the facilities on these old buildings on sleds that they'd pull down and put in place for the year down there. And once that was done, I would lay out some routes over the sea ice to like Marble Point or something for a dry valley area for scientists. Yeah. And they'd fly down the South Pole to do some construction or various other spots in Antarctica. Wind up coming home on the last flight in March. Repeat.
How cold does it get there?
Depends where you're at. At McMurdo itself, during the summer, it's minus 10-ish.
In summer?
Yeah. And the winter obviously is cold. The wind chill can take it down, but the reverse, the wind is not blowing and the sun is out. The thermal radiation is so intense. You could be out there in a t-shirt.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize that.
And yeah, so it's very interesting place. Of all the jobs I've had, that's the one that I still to this day would say was the best experience ever.
What's the coldest you've experienced?
Probably minus 50, 60.
Yeah.
Down, I went up to Dome Charlie or something like that. I don't remember.
Okay.
Once it gets lower than 20.
It doesn't matter. It's cold.
The difference is just relative.
So you mentioned something about blowing things up. Yep. in Antarctica.
Correct.
What was that all about? Now, you're not fighting people, but you are fighting the elements.
Correct.
And you're trying to make it safe for people to navigate, ships to navigate to the bases or whatever, the research stations and so on. So what, what's blowing things up then?
Over the years, with ships tied up to the ice shelf down at McMurdo, the warm water from the ships being pumped overside would erode the ice, and they just came closer and closer to shore. And they said, we can't bring ships here anymore if we don't do something. So there was a project to build an artificial floating ice wharf, about 750 feet long, 350 feet wide, reinforced with cables and all that. And most of it was built over, winter period where there's surface flooding and pumps and that.
Now, is this dark?
Yeah.
It's dark. It's dark 24 hours a day for that period of the season.
Yeah. And I wasn't there during that time. I was considered summer support, even though I flew in early and left.
Well, aren't you lucky?
Yeah. And then you put dirt over it, and there you go. The problem was the sea ice froze up against the side of the wharf. And so how do you create a nice edge that the icebreaker can come and peel the sea ice away in that? And I developed blasting techniques to cut the sea ice away from the ice wharf. And then the following year had to do even more because the warm water from the ships was eroding into the wharf itself. And so I had to blast through 35 feet of ice and put a straight edge. But then then the little piece of engineering we devised was, they have this, have you ever heard of MoMat?
No.
MoMat is a fiberglass resin impregnated, not funny chrome, but a basically grid that's on a roll. And that's what they would roll up beaches when you're going to salt the beach, and then vehicles could drive up the MoMat.
Oh, okay.
And so we had some of that down there, and we basically made a curtain out of it to hang in front of the edge of the ice wharf. And that really reduced the water and ice melt.
Wow. Now, how many months or whatever you think it's committed to Antarctica? Sounds like you came and left and then come back.
Yeah.
This would be in the 70s?
Yeah, it'd be 76 to 79.
Okay.
It would be
off and on.
A year and a half, maybe a little longer.
Okay. So mission accomplished at the end.
Mission accomplished at the end.
Yeah. And so did you get promoted as a result of that?
The promotion from 01 to 02 at the time was automatic. And so I was it's just paperwork driven. I was promoted. And then in my next job, I was promoted to lieutenant.
Okay. So you're doing through the 70s, 80s, 90s, various engineering tasks assigned in different places around the world. Yes or no? I don't know.
Yeah, actually mostly West Coast.
Okay.
I was down at El Toro for a while, and then we went up. I ran the construction contracts office out on Adak, Alaska, which is about two-thirds of the way out on the Aleutian chain. Did that for a couple of years.
So you went from the South Pole closer to the North Pole and places in between.
Actually, Adak is about the same latitude as slightly north of Vancouver.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the way the islands
basically northern way.
During this time, what do you think was your most challenging assignment, maybe?
During my active duty time?
Active duty time. During the...
Oh, active duty time. The most challenging was definitely Antarctica, because I have to think outside the box, learn how to navigate in a whiteout.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. When you're down there, you're an officer, you don't have your primary job. You have these secondary jobs. I was surface search and rescue officer and other things. And so if they're Huey down.
A helicopter?
I'd have to go out and
Find them. Yeah. Just never boring day. Or was it?
They were warm day. Our typical work day was about 14 hours. And we mostly had both Sundays off. The weekly holiday was Saturday night at the club.
Oh, okay. We may not want to go in there.
No, it's just foosball, darts, and beer.
Then you get down, 9/11 comes.
Right.
Was there that kind of a change for you?
Yeah, I was a reservist, still working for the Navy. And basically the top admiral was my boss both ways, as a civilian, as a in military. 9/11 was on a Tuesday. I was scheduled to assume my new command out in the Pacific that Friday the 14th. And so ultimately happened is we did an email change of command on Wednesday. And SeaTac, pretty much one of the first flights out of SeaTac, well, delayed, but that Friday, down to San Diego, where my first job was to figure out how to scatter people to all sorts of different locations and send people home and make sure your affairs are in order. We meet up at the McChord Air Base up in Washington, and we go. And that's where you disappear. You're gone for a while, and you get back when you get back.
And quite literally, your wife didn't even know where you were.
Correct. As a respiratory therapist, she'd be at the hospital. And how's Kevin? I don't know. Where is he? Don't know. When's he coming back? Don't know.
But you knew. Hey, do you know where you were or what you were doing?
Correct.
But it was top secret at the moment, at the time.
Yeah.
You were busy. You were busy.
Yeah, it was a very busy time. When you're fully invested in the reserves, it's just not weekend drills, 2 weeks in the summer. You got a lot of work. I was putting old ladies work in my civil service job in about 20 hours a week on my reserve stuff. And yeah, you're busy.
You're busy. Now, did you do some stuff in the Middle East?
Yeah, we did have detachments at various spots in the Middle East, Bahrain, people out of Diego Garcia and other locations.
Now, would you be basically coordinating operations and construction projects or whatever in multiple areas at the same time?
There's some construction stuff. I was directly in charge of the environmental engineering unit Pacific, and our job would have been to do what's called wide area decontamination, which is, those tanker trucks that spread water.
Yes.
When you take a truck like that and get it to spread or spray a chemical, which are called HTH, highly chlorinated, toxic in itself. But if you spread over a road, or we call our main supply route an MSR, you drive up, it didn't matter what they use for either chemical or biological or whatever, the HTH would kill it. And then you then had access to go inland. And so that would have been one of the primary jobs over there. Fortunately, we did not need to conduct those types of operations.
But you were ready to if necessary.
Oh, correct. You have all the mop gear, which is basically the chemical biological suits and that and washdown areas. Yeah.
You just had to be the Swiss Army knife of naval CBs and so on, just multiple jobs and obstacles to overcome, problems to solve, and so on.
And there's a secret. It's not a secret, but it's kind of, when I've looked back at my career, it's kind of, wow, did I really do all that stuff? Number one, you don't think about it at the time. And I say, if you get up every day and move forward, you'll wind up in places or do things that you would never have dreamed of, maybe never would have thought about. And so when I take a look at my career, I just kept going and put your head down, you do the work. And then, Kev, we need to have you go do this. So we need you to do this in East Timor, or you got someone you can send to Jakarta, or you just keep pressing forward and moving on. And then I guess it accumulates over time. You don't think about it until you eventually get around to looking back at it.
So, yeah, you accumulate jobs you did, successes, probably maybe some failures, things that didn't go the way you wanted them. We've talked a little bit about some of your successes. Is there a couple of things that did not go as you had hoped that you would want to share? Something like, oh, that didn't work. Or,
yeah. And
nobody's going to bat 1,000.
No, I don't bat 1,000. I'm trying to protect the innocent on a couple things.
Okay.
One thing I found out, it was a hard lesson for me to learn, in that at times politics doesn't care about you doing the right thing. And that really had to do with a environmental cleanup, or actually at Jackson Park on the Kitsap Peninsula Community Housing Unit used to be a weapons assembly place during the Second War, with primarily naval 5-inch shells and things like that. And we were doing a cleanup there and got into a dispute with the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and I got very explicit orders from back in the Beltway to do something, and I followed them out. It was the right thing to do at a conclusion, and then all of a sudden, radio silence back there, and I did the wrong thing. The political wind shifted, and I got hammered for it.
You didn't really do the wrong thing.
No, I mean, in fact, it was a number of years later with some of the people that were on the periphery said, you did the right thing back then. That didn't help then. I got hammered pretty.
So it's challenging. I'm sure to some varying degree, whether you just had multiple, you had to fight the elements.
Mm-hmm.
You had to sometimes fight human enemy. Sometimes. Some of your men did, or doing assignments.
Yeah.
Sometimes you had to fight the politicians.
Correct.
And sometimes you had to maybe fight politicians / superior officers.
I've had my run-in with an admiral or two.
Yes.
So when I was coming in zone for admiral, I just said, no, I'm retiring. I don't want to join your club.
Oh, the opportunity was there.
You need it.
Okay.
You need it, but fine.
Now, sometimes nicknames that have been earned or tagged onto an individual says something about the individual,
yeah,
and their experiences at the time. And you seem to, you've had some nicknames. Everybody does. Nicknames says things about people. So what are some of the interesting nicknames that you earned in your career that might say a little bit about you and what you learned and stuff?
The one I won't talk about was Tox, which was short for toxic. It's not suitable for a podcast, but The first one, I'm a brand new officer. I'm down in Port Hueneme. We're practicing for a change of command. We're in our green fatigues at the time. Got the officers drawing the swords, and I drew my brand new sword, and the blade came out from the hilt and just went, and it just...
Like a helicopter.
Yeah, and it clattered, and then people were looking at me, and the butt knob on the hilt dropped and rolled and kept rolling, and there's no reason that should have rolled that far on a level surface. But yeah, you're the new officer, you're supposed to mess up, and a lot of laughing. But we deployed down to Antarctica, and we're eating dinner, and at the time, you know, they have these metal military trays, and had a fork on the edge of the tray, and we were talking, and that my hand went down, and the fork goes boing, it goes back somewhere, and I turn around, and the commanding of the skipper, Navy Captain Lefty Nordhill, hands me my fork back, but it has his cake attached to it. Joe, this is have to stop. And so
this has to stop. Yes, I'm doing this.
He was laughing, everybody's laughing. And so I got fun with the nickname Forks for a little bit. A little remarks, hey, it's about time you stick a fork in it. And when will you be back, or whatever? It's all legend, and at the time, and later on, I was a lieutenant engineering officer for a regional medical center at Camp Pendleton, and I had branch clinics on base, 29 Palms, Barstow, and one up at Marine Mountain Warfare Training Center in Bridgeport, California, which is west of Tahoe. And the way you get there, you fly into Tahoe, get your rental car, and go. I got in there expecting my compact government rate rental car, and they said, we don't have anything, we only have one car on the lot, here's the keys, go. And so I go out there, and there I am showing up at Mountain Warfare Training Centers with Marine sentries there in a pink Cadillac. And so I very quickly assumed the moniker of Pinks.
Pinks.
Very affectionate, because CBs and Marines are very tight and all that, but it was just here, the look on the Marines' faces seeing this guy pipe up in a pink Cadillac.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Why did you have a pink Cadillac?
It was the only car left on the lot. And so they handed me the keys to it.
And that, there it is.
Yeah, and so got it for the government rate of, at the time, $19 a day or whatever it was.
Now I'm gonna push your memory here. What year was that? What year was the pink Cadillac?
The pink Cadillac would have been, that would have been in 82.
Okay.
Around that.
So it was big. It was a big boat.
Oh, yeah. It was a big boat. Yeah, I never drove anything that big. And when you're going up to the Mount Moore for a training center, you're going, man, oh, boy, it takes the curve.
Oh, boy. So that was, that your most, it's just a ride you'll never forget, the car itself.
Yeah, it's, that was just...
And they could see you coming from a long ways away.
And I was up there in the work on the project. We're going to put in a modular clinic because their operations, the number of people were growing, but they couldn't wait 7 years for a normal project.
Okay. Now you did some projects in the Holy Land.
No, I didn't do anything in the Holy Land. I just visited.
Oh, okay. So that was later after.
Right. That was actually, 2018. Something.
Okay. You had mentioned, how did you view as an engineer, once an engineer, always an engineer. Okay. What were your impressions of the Holy Land through the eyes of an engineer?
Everything is new. Whatever you may see for pictures or you know, whatever, it's just not the same. Just putting eyeballs on something. And we pulled into Ashdod Seaport and you get on a bus. You go to Jerusalem, and our first stop was the Western Wall, which I thought was, and I was just amazed looking at the culture. And when you look at the Western Wall, and they have it segregated where the right one third is women only, and the left two thirds is men only, and they said, okay, that's how they want to do it. So the density of the women there are about, I wouldn't say exactly the same ratio as men, but pretty close. A lot more people packed into a smaller place on the right-hand side. And then you look at what's going on the men's side, and a Jew is not a Jew. You have people that are wearing Dockers and polo shirts and all that. You have Hasidic with the black coats and all that. And then they have more Orthodox there with the desk, scriptures, incense, and that. So you're watching all this and you're going, wow, this is really interesting. They're all coming together and all that. And the real funny thing is with the Jewish men wearing Dockers and polo shirts, praying at the wall, putting note to me, whatever, then they get out their cell phones, call up their brother, whoever on it. And then they put the cell phone against the wall. So their uncle or whatever can pray as well. I said, isn't that great? God can take cell phone calls at the Western Wall. I was impressed.
Who would know that? Yeah.
Yeah. And so things that you don't find written down there. Went out to the Bethlehem, the church of the Nativity. And I'll tell you that Church of the Holy Sepulchre back in Jerusalem, you have Catholics, the Orthodox, and the Armenian. And they agree the walkway of Jesus with all the stations for his crucifixion and all that, the various spots where various things happened. Could be there, could not be there, but the three agree. This is the spot for that. But over at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, space is within the millimeter. This is our space. You can't go out, and that's why they have a ladder on a window ledge out there that no one's retrieved because somebody violated the space because it was past the window. That's been there for centuries. So, yeah, you just see things that are, you go, wow.
Yeah.
And the funny thing at the Church of the Nativity out at Bethlehem, which is a Palestinian-run town. We're going through there, and all of a sudden I'm seeing, which is obviously heavy security force there, walk around the corner and almost walked into Prime Minister Abe from Japan, who happened to be visiting there that day. You know, so it's just odd.
So how did your trip to the Holy Land impact you spiritually?
Spiritually, it actually, in many ways, gave me more perspective, especially for what's important. And also, one spot we stopped at, so this is where it makes sense. And we were coming back to Ashdod on the bus, and we pull over, and our guy gets us out. And so this is a valley, I think it's called Elah. It's where David and Goliath, had their fight, and they're pointing, she's pointing at different hilltops, and said, the reason why we know this is that in Aramaic and fire languages and all that, these hills have had the same name, and so they're absolutely certain of that. And so my military mind clicks in, and I look at the two hills and all that, think of the size of what the army, quote-unquote armies, would be at that time, and said, it actually really fits Scripture, because for those of faith and all that, it's wonderful, but the topography matches what was going on there. The hills are situated that you could pretty much run up each other's flank or something like that. And yeah, it would. And it said, yeah, this fits. This makes sense. So I think if you go back there and spend more time there, you find, makes more sense.
And so your faith that the Bible is accurate is deepened.
Yeah. That's right. It'll get deeper, because you see things that, how should you say, a little more independently confirm stuff.
Because we can all, I wonder what.
Yeah.
You don't have to rely on your imagination so much. There it is. And it makes sense now. Yeah.
Yeah. When we're out in Jordan, we went out the Wadi Rum and said, this looks familiar, and like that. I've seen this before. That's Lawrence of Arabia and all that. And they filmed it on location. When you go out there, the location hasn't changed much.
So as a man of engineering and apparently, obviously, a man of faith, the two come together very well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've never found, an incompatibility. Once you learn a little bit something, then you realize how much more vast the rest of it is. And so that's been my trend over my life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So did you have any difficulty in the transition from military to civilian? Because it sounds like it blended in and then flowed, but.
But I went to work for the same military organization I was officer in, and I was doing reserve stuff. And wound up doing both, but I did not have an issue of, hey, I'm a civil servant, I'm doing my job, I'm not throwing military rank around or whatever. That said, I would often, after hours, mentor other naval officers. They didn't have to be from our organization that were going to be transitioning to civilian life. And listen, you might as well have the benefit of my experience.
And we have, I think, an unusually high, I don't know the exact numbers, but we have a high number of veterans up here in North Idaho. And I'm sure they would really benefit from your experience and so on.
You remember Lenny Oshak?
No.
How long have you been up here?
We moved here about 12, 13 years ago.
Okay. He'd been to the parade downtown.
Yes.
And all that. You remember the Navy captain that was wearing the Joker white uniform?
Okay.
That was Lenny Oshak.
Yeah. Oh. Okay.
Her homework assignment is to Google Operation Cold Feet.
Okay.
And read a little bit now. You want to talk about a hero that he did work with the CIA and a few other things. And that is a fascinating story. And he just lived right down there in Old Town, and passed away. He's in Arlington now. But you'd be amazed at the people that you'll run into up here with their backgrounds.
We're about to run out of time here. Do you have a couple of particularly proudest moments from your military days?
What is art? What's brought me the most pride beyond anything, and forget any paper or ribbon or fruit salad on your chest, is I'm proud that I brought my people home alive, pure and simple. And to be able to do that is a lot of work, and you worry And as a commanding officer, you fret about your people, you pay attention to what's going on, making sure your people have the resources they need to do their job and to protect themselves, or others to help them to protect themselves. I do remember when I retired, I turned over my last command in that, and it felt, you remember when you take off your roller skates and all of a sudden your feet are very light? That's what it felt like. I felt like I took off roller skates and all that. The burden of command is now no longer yours, and you don't realize how much of a burden or weight it is until it's removed. By far, bringing my people home.
Yes. And you didn't just have to worry about, are they going to get ambushed in a firefight somewhere or whatever? You had to worry about, might there be an accident on the work site? Might there be the natural elements of the weather and so on, and various things.
Yeah, and one other thing, real briefly, I'm most proud of it is putting people in the right position to do well. I have a very dear friend who was passed over, didn't get promoted a couple times to captain. And I said, well, if you work for me, I'll give you a paper. But don't leave the Navy on their terms. Leave the Navy on your terms. You did. You got promoted. And at the time in the Middle East, the Army was was tasked to restore oil production in Iraq. The Navy captain was the one that was selected to be the oil sector chair. He did that, did great work, was well respected, and came back and all that. I helped put him in a place where he could make a difference. And it's those kinds of things that are the worthwhile things.
Kevin, I want to say as we wrap this up, I really am humbled and respect and thank you for your service. I look at your resume and in visiting with you here this past almost an hour, and the things you experienced and the impact you had on so many people. I look back at my life and I have nothing to be ashamed of, but wow, you just had so many experiences that kind of, like I said, just humbles me. So thank you for your service and thank you for your time. And I know you had to sacrifice a lot, but you were probably away from home quite a bit.
We were married 5.5 years before we hit the halfway point where we were actually together more than.
See, yeah, that's not easy. And of course you had children.
Yeah.
And you had to, they had everything. A military family has to make sacrifices.
Right.
So I just salute you and thank you very much for your time and all of our veterans. And It's a challenge that honestly, when I was 20 years old, 21, 22, I chose not to do that. And you chose to do it. That's a big deal.
It's a matter of choosing something and going forward every day. You don't necessarily know where it's going to take you. But if you're doing the right thing, it'll work out.
Yeah. So any closing thoughts? There was a couple of topics that we could have got into, but we just didn't have time.
Well, I'm fine for that. Certainly appreciate the invite. And to the listeners out there, have fun, help people, and go forward every day.
There you go. And guys, if you have any reasons to maybe follow up, and if you want to contact Kevin, if you want to have coffee with him, you can reach out either directly to him or through me. Go ahead, Kevin.
Feel free.
Through me. My email address is very available to you. It's northidahopodcast@gmail.com. And I do get emails, and most of them are pretty good. Once in a while, I get a criticism, and that's fine. I learn from that. But so, yeah, if you want to touch base with Kevin or whatever, just reach out to me. I will get a hold of him, and then he can contact you. And Kevin is a private citizen now. He's a civilian.
I love being a private citizen.
Do you? I'll bet you do. And so, anyway, reach out, and I hope all of you have a nice weekend and a nice week and weekend coming up. And we'll have another podcast here in a few days. As we wrap up today's conversation, and Captain Ball has now left the studio, I want to pause and reflect on the weight of command that our guest,
Captain Ball carried. When we hear the word CB, most of us picture construction, airstrips in remote places, bridges spanning rivers, or bases rising out of bare ground. But behind every one of those projects was something far more important, the people who carried them out. Every blueprint, every order, every decision was about more than steel and concrete. It was about safeguarding the men under his command, men who looked to him for direction, for protection, and for the hope of making it home. That's a burden of leadership most of us will never fully know. Scripture tells us that to whom much is given, much is required. And that was in Luke 12:48. Command is never about privilege. It's about accountability before your people and before God. Listening to Captain Ball, I was reminded of Nehemiah, who rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem. He worked with a trowel in one hand and a sword in the other, building and protecting at the same time. That's the same balance a CB commander carries, vision to construct and vigilance to defend. Ezekiel calls the leader a watchman, one set on the wall to guard those entrusted to his care. That's what Captain Ball lived out. Eyes always forward, protecting his men while pressing the mission forward. And that responsibility doesn't end when the project is finished or the deployment is over. It leaves a mark. It shapes a leader into someone who cares that success isn't measured only in what's built, but in the lives preserved along the way. The runways, the facilities, the shelters, those matter, yes. But the greater legacy is trust, loyalty, and the safe return of those who served under his command. And that, I think, is a lesson for all of us. Leadership, whether in the military, at work, in the community, or even in our families, is never about recognition or titles. It's about stewardship. It's about taking care of those entrusted to us, guiding with wisdom, and sacrificing so others can thrive. Captain Ball's story shows us that true leadership builds more than structures. It builds confidence, stability, and hope. And it reminds us that the best leaders are remembered not just for what they accomplished, but for how they served. So may we take that to heart. In our own callings, may we lead with the same courage, humility, and faith. And may we, like Captain Ball, seek to build not only what will last on this earth, but what will echo into eternity. Thank you, Captain Kevin Ball, for your service and your sacrifice.